Volkov. Continued, Cassette 7, Side 2. In the world of symbols, everything is either this or that. In the world of experience, there are more alternatives available. For example, consider the judge who must try his own son in a court of law. The law allows only two verdicts. He is guilty and he is innocent. For the judge, however, there is another possible verdict, namely, he is my son. The fact that we prohibit judges from trying cases in which they have a personal interest is a tacit admission that experience is not limited to the categorical alternatives of guilty and innocent, or good and bad, etc. Only in the realm of symbols is the choice so clear. During the Lebanese Civil War, a story goes, a visiting American was stopped by a group of masked gunmen. One wrong word could cost him his life. "Are you Christian or Muslim?" they asked. "I am a tourist," he cried. The way that we pose our questions often illusorily limits our responses. In this case, the visitor's fear for his life broke through this illusion. Similarly, the way that we think our thoughts illusorily limits us to a perspective of either or. Experience itself is never so limited. There is always an alternative between every this and every that. The recognition of this quality of experience is an integral part of quantum logic. Physicists engage in a particular kind of dance which is foreign to most of us. Being around them for any length of time is like entering another culture. Within this culture, every statement is subject to the challenge, prove it. When we tell a friend, "I feel great this morning," we do not expect him to say, "Prove it." However, when a physicist says, "Experience is not bound by the same rules as symbols," he invites a chorus of "Prove it's." Until he can do this, he must preface his remarks with, "It is my opinion that." Physicists are not very impressed with opinions. Unfortunately, this sometimes makes them narrow-minded to an extraordinary degree. If you are not willing to follow their dance, they won't dance with you. Their dance requires a proof for every assertion. A proof does not verify that an assertion is true, that that is the way the world really is. A scientific proof is a mathematical demonstration that the assertion in question is logically consistent. In the realm of pure mathematics, an assertion may have no relevance to experience at all. Nonetheless, if it is accompanied by a self-consistent proof, it is accepted. If it is not, it is rejected. The same is true of physics, except that the science of physics imposes the additional requirement that the assertion relate to physical reality. So much for the relationship between the truth of a scientific assertion and the nature of reality. There isn't any. Scientific truth has nothing to do with the way that reality really is. A scientific theory is true if it is self-consistent and correctly correlates experience, or predicts events. In short, when a scientist says that a theory is true, he means that it correctly correlates experience and therefore it is useful. If we substitute the word useful whenever we encounter the word true, physics appears in its proper perspective. Birkhoff and von Neumann created a proof that experience violates the rules of classical logic. This proof, of course, is embedded in experience. In particular, it is based upon what does and does not happen with various combinations of polarized light. Finkelstein uses a slightly modified version of Birkhoff and von Neumann's original proof to demonstrate quantum logic. The first step of this proof is to experiment with all of the possible combinations of horizontally, vertically, and diagonally polarized light. In other words, the first step is to do what we have done already, discover which light emissions pass through which polarizers. We have seen that light passes through two vertical polarizers, two horizontal polarizers, two diagonal polarizers, a diagonal and a horizontal polarizer, and a diagonal and a vertical polarizer. All of these combinations are called allowed transitions because they actually happen. Similarly, we can see that light does not pass through a horizontal and a vertical polarizer or any other combination of polarizers oriented at right angles to each other. These combinations are called forbidden transitions because they never happen. The second step of the proof is to make a table of this information called a transition table. This table is made up of a series of squares resembling an enormous tic-tac-toe board. To the left, running down vertically, are letters representing emissions. An emission is just what it sounds like. In this case, an emission is a light wave that is emitted from a light bulb. The letters are, starting from the top, a zero with a line through it, pronounced O, standing for the null process. The null process means that we decided to go to the movies today and not do the experiment. The null process stands for no emissions, nothing. H means horizontally polarized light emitting from a horizontal polarizer. V means vertically polarized light emitting from a vertical polarizer. D represents light diagonally polarized to the left, and a D with a bar over it, or D bar, represents light diagonally polarized to the right. Finally, the letter I stands for identity process. The identity process is a filter that passes everything. In other words, I tells us what kinds of polarized light pass through, say, an open window, namely, every kind. Across the top of the table, we place the same letters, starting from the left, O, H, V, D, D bar, and I. These letters represent admissions. An admission is the reception of an emission. To use the transition table, we pick the type of emission in which we are interested and follow it across the table. For example, an emission of horizontally polarized light, H, our second letter down from the top, will pass through another horizontal polarizer, following across to the admission, horizontal. So an A for allowed is placed in the square where the horizontally polarized emission line intersects the horizontally polarized admission column. Horizontally polarized light also passes through a diagonal polarizer tilted to the left, a diagonal polarizer tilted to the right, and an open window, I. An A is placed in each appropriate square. We might notice that the square where the horizontally polarized emission line intersects the vertically polarized admission column is blank. This is because horizontally polarized light does not pass through a vertical polarizer. The blank squares on the table show the forbidden transitions. All of the null process squares, or O, are blank because nothing happens if we don't do the experiment. All of the I squares are marked A because every kind of light, polarized and otherwise, passes through an open window. The third step in the proof is to make a simple diagram of the information contained in the transition table. The diagram made from this particular transition table has three distinct levels. The bottom level is labeled O, or null process. It is a point from which four lines extend upward. The four lines extend to the second level, creating four distinct points, H, D, D bar, and V. These are labeled singlets. The four lines then turn abruptly, angling up and inward, to intersect again at the third level, labeled I, or doublet. The diagram roughly resembles two diamond shapes, one encased inside another. The diamond shapes intersect at the bottom level and intersect again at the top level. This type of diagram is called a lattice. Mathematicians use lattices to show the ordering of events or elements. Lattices are similar to the genealogical trees that we construct when we research our family roots. The higher elements include the lower elements. The lines show who is connected to whom and through whom. A lattice is not exactly a family tree, but it shows the same kind of inclusive ordering. At the bottom is the null process. Nothing is below the null process, since the null process represents no emissions of any kind. In the next level up are the various states of polarization. The elements at this level are called singlets. Singlets are the simplest statements that we can make about the polarization of a light wave. This light wave is horizontally polarized. H is the most that we can say about the state of polarization, even though it doesn't tell us anything else. It is a maximal but incomplete description, a limitation inherent in the use of language. The next level up contains the doublets. In this lattice, there is only one doublet. Doublets comprise the next level of maximal but incomplete statements that we can make about the polarization of light in this simple experiment. Lattices representing more complex phenomena can have considerably more levels, triplets, quadruplets, etc. This lattice is the simplest of them all, but it graphically demonstrates the nature of quantum logic. First, notice that the doublet, I, at the top, contains four singlets. In other words, four lines meet at the top of the lattice diagram. This is typical of quantum logic, but an incomprehensible contradiction to classical logic, wherein every doublet, by definition, contains only two singlets, no more and no less. Lattices are graphic demonstrations of the quantum postulate that there is always at least one alternative between every this and every that. In this case, two alternatives, D and D bar, are represented. There are many more available alternatives that are not represented in this lattice. For example, the light in the lattice represented by the symbol D bar is diagonally polarized at 45 degrees, but we also can polarize light at 46 degrees, 47 degrees, 48.5 degrees, etc. And all of these states of polarization could be included in the doublet at the top, I. In both classical logic and quantum logic, a singlet can be represented by a dot. In classical logic, a doublet is represented by two dots. In quantum logic, however, a doublet is represented by a line drawn between the two dots. All of the points on the line are included in the doublet, not only the two points that define it. Now, let us return to the distributive law. A and B, or C, equals A and B, or A and C. The whole purpose of making a transition table was to make a lattice to use in the disproving of the distributive law. Mathematicians use lattice diagrams to determine which elements in the lattice are connected and in what way. For example, to see how two elements in the lattice are connected by the word AND, follow the lines leading from the elements in question down to a point where they both meet, which mathematicians call the greatest lower bound. If we're interested in H and D, we follow the lines downward from H and from D and find that they meet at O, or null process. Therefore, the lattice tells us that H and D, or horizontal and diagonal, equals O, or null process. If we're interested in I and H, we follow the line downward from the highest starting point on the lattice, I, and find that the lowest common point of I and H is H. Therefore, the lattice tells us that I and H equals H. To see how two elements in the lattice are connected by the word OR, follow the lines leading from the elements in question up to a point where they both meet, which mathematicians call the least upper bound. For example, if we're interested in H or V, horizontal or vertical, we follow the lines upward from H and from V and find that they meet at the top at I. Therefore, the lattice tells us that H or V equals I. Similarly, to find D or I, we follow the lines upward to their highest common point, which is I. Therefore, the lattice tells us that D or I equals I. The rule is simple. And we follow the lines down, or we follow the lines up. Go down the lattice to find and, go up the lattice to find or. Now we come to the proof itself. The proof itself is considerably simpler than the preliminary explanations. The distributive law says that A and B or C equals A and B or A and C. To see whether this is true of experience or not, we simply insert some of our actual states of polarization into the formula and solve it using the lattice method. For example, the distributive law says that horizontally polarized light and vertically polarized light or diagonally polarized light equals horizontally polarized light and vertically polarized light or horizontally polarized light and diagonally polarized light. Using the abbreviations that we have already used, this is written H and D or V equals H and D or H and V. Returning to the lattice, let us examine the left side of this statement first. Solving for D or V, we follow the lines on the lattice upward from D and from V to their highest common point, or goes up. They meet at the top, at I. Therefore, the lattice tells us that D or V equals I. Substituting I for the original D or V, we have left on this side of the statement H and I. Following the lines from H and I downward on the lattice, and goes down, we find that their lowest common point is at H. Therefore, the lattice tells us that H and I equals H. In short, our original equation read H and D or V equals H and D or H and V. Our next step was H and I, D or V equaling I, equals H and D or H and V. And our final step was H and I equals H. Therefore, H equals H and D or H and V. We've solved the left side of the equation. We've come to the answer H. Now we solve the right side of the statement in the same way. Solving for H and D, we follow the lines in the lattice downward from H and from D to their lowest common point. They meet at O. Therefore, the lattice tells us that H and D equals O. Substituting O for H and D, we're left with O or H and V on the right side of the statement. To solve for H and V, we follow the lines on the lattice downward from H and from V to their lowest common point. They also intersect at O. Therefore, the lattice tells us that H and V equals O. Substituting O for H and V, we are now left with O or O on the right side of the original statement. Both the lattice and common sense tell us that O or O equals O. In short, our first step, H equals H and D or H and V. Our next step, H equals O or H and V. Our next step, H equals O or O. And our final step was H equals O. But H does not equal O. H is horizontally polarized light, and O is a non-experiment, a lack of any emission at all. The distributive law does not work. Here is Birkhoff and von Neumann's proof again. It is important because, simple as it is, it could end an illusion millennia old. The illusion that symbols and experience follow the same set of rules. Except for the mathematical symbols that represent the connectives and or, this is exactly the way that physicists read it. H and D or V equals H and D or H and V. H and I equals O or H and V. H equals O or O. H does not equal O. Finkelstein's theory is a theory of process. Quantum logic is only one part of it. According to this theory, the basic unit of the universe is an event or a process. These events link in certain ways, allowed transitions, to form webs. The webs in turn join to form larger webs. Farther up the ladder of organization are coherent superpositions of different webs, things which are neither this web nor that web, but distinct entities in themselves. The basic events of Finkelstein's theory do not exist in space and time. They are prior to space and time. According to Finkelstein, space, time, mass, and energy are secondary qualities which are derived from the basic events of the universe. In fact, Finkelstein's latest paper is called Beneath Time. This bold theory is a radical departure from conventional physics and from conventional thought. The mathematics of Finkelstein's theory, which is called quantum topology, is remarkably simple compared to the complex mathematics of quantum theory and relativity. Quantum topology is as yet incomplete, lacking proof. Like many theories, it may never be complete. Unlike most other theories, however, it contains the potential to alter radically our conceptual framework. Von Neumann's discovery that our thought processes, the realm of symbols, project illusory restrictions onto the real world is essentially the same discovery that led Einstein to the general theory of relativity. Einstein disproved the universality of Euclidean geometry. Until the general theory of relativity, Euclidean geometry had been accepted without question as the underlying structure of the universe. Birkhoff and von Neumann disproved the universality of classical logic. Until now, classical logic has been accepted without question as a natural reflection of the nature of reality. A powerful awareness lies dormant in these discoveries, an awareness of the hitherto unsuspected powers of the mind to mold reality rather than the other way round. In this sense, the philosophy of physics is becoming indistinguishable from the philosophy of Buddhism, which is the philosophy of enlightenment. Chapter 1. The last chapter. The end of science. A vital aspect of the enlightened state is the experience of an all-pervading unity. This and that no longer are separate entities. They are different forms of the same thing. Everything is a manifestation. It is not possible to answer the question, manifestation of what, because the what is that which is beyond words, beyond concept, beyond form, beyond even space and time. Everything is a manifestation of that which is. That which is. Beyond these words lies the experience of that which is. The forms through which that which is manifests itself are each and every one of them perfect. We are manifestations of that which is. Everything is a manifestation of that which is. Everything and everybody is exactly and perfectly what it is. A 14th century Tibetan Buddhist, Longchenpa, wrote, "Since everything is but an apparition, perfect in being what it is, having nothing to do with good or bad, acceptance or rejection, one may well burst out in laughter." We might say, God's in his heaven and all's well with the world, except that according to the enlightened view, the world couldn't be any other way. It is neither well nor not well. It simply is what it is. What it is perfectly what it is. It couldn't be anything else. It is perfect. I am perfect. I am exactly and perfectly who I am. You are perfect. You are exactly and perfectly who you are. If you are a happy person, and that is what you perfectly are, a happy person. If you are an unhappy person, then that is what you perfectly are, an unhappy person. If you are a person who is changing, then that is what you perfectly are, a person who is changing. That which is that which is. That which is not, is that which is. There is nothing which is not that which is. There is nothing other than that which is. Everything is that which is. We are a part of that which is. In fact, we are that which is. If we substitute subatomic particles for people in this scheme, we have a good approximation of the conceptual dynamics of particle physics. Yet there is another sense in which this aspect of unity has entered physics. the pioneers of quantum physics noticed a strange connectedness among quantum phenomena. Until recently, this oddity lacked any theoretical significance. It was regarded as an accidental feature which could be explained as the theory developed. In 1964, J.S. Bell, a physicist at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN or CERN in Switzerland, zeroed in on this strange connectedness in a manner that may make it the central focus of physics in the future. Dr. Bell published a mathematical proof which came to be known as Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem was reworked and refined over the following 10 years until it emerged in its present form. Its present form is dramatic, to say the least. Bell's theorem is a mathematical construct which, as such, is indecipherable to the non-mathematician. Its implications, however, could affect profoundly our basic worldview. Some physicists are convinced that it is the most important single work, perhaps, in the history of physics. One of the implications of Bell's theorem is that, at a deep and fundamental level, the separate parts of the universe are connected in an intimate and immediate way. In short, Bell's theorem and the enlightened experience of unity are very compatible. The unexplained connectedness of quantum phenomena shows itself in several ways. The first way we have already discussed. It is the double-slit experiment. When both slits in a double-slit experiment are open, the light waves going through them interfere with each other to form a pattern of alternating light and dark bands on a screen. When only one slit in a double-slit experiment is open, the light waves going through it illuminate the screen in the ordinary way. How does a single photon in a double-slit experiment know whether or not it can go to an area on the screen that must be dark if both slits are open? The great multitude of photons, of which a single photon eventually will be a part, distributes itself in one way if one slit is open, and in an entirely different way if both slits are open. The question is, assuming that a single photon goes through one of the two slits, how does it know whether or not the other slit is open? Somehow it does. An interference pattern always forms when we open both slits, and it never forms when we close one of the slits. However, there is another experiment in which this apparent connectedness of quantum phenomena is even more perplexing. Suppose that we have what physicists call a two-particle system of zero spin. This means that the spin of each of the particles in the system cancels the other. If one of the particles in such a system has a spin up, the other particle has a spin down. If the first particle has a spin right, the second particle has a spin left. No matter how the particles are oriented, their spins are always equal and opposite. Now suppose that we separate these two particles in some way that does not affect their spin, like electrically. One particle goes off in one direction and the other particle goes off in the opposite direction. The spin of a subatomic particle can be oriented by a magnetic field. For example, if a beam of electrons with randomly oriented spin is sent through a particular type of magnetic field, called a Stern-Gerlach device, the magnetic field splits the beam into two equal smaller beams. In one of them, all of the electrons have a spin up, and in the other, all of the electrons have a spin down. If only one electron goes through this magnetic field, it will come out of it with either a spin up or a spin down. We can design the experiment so that the odds are 50-50. If we reorientate the magnetic field, change its axis, we can give all of the electrons a spin right or a spin left instead of a spin up or a spin down. If only one electron goes through the magnetic field when it is oriented this way, it will come out of it with either a spin right or a spin left, equal chance either way. Now suppose that after we separate our original two-particle system, we send one of the particles through a magnetic field that will give it either a spin up or a spin down. In this case, let us say that the particle comes out of the magnetic field with a spin up. This means that we automatically know that the other particle has a spin down. We do not have to make a measurement on the other particle because we know that its spin is equal to and opposite to that of its twin. So, our experiment is conducted this way. The original two-particle system with zero spin is at the center. We separate the two particles. One of the particles goes to the right through a Stern-Gerlach device. In this case, the Stern-Gerlach device gives it a spin up. Therefore, we know without measuring that the other particle, which has gone to the left, has a spin down. Albert Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen thought up this experiment over 45 years ago. Actually, this version of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, using spin states, was thought up by David Bohm, a physicist at the University of London. This version usually is used to illustrate the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect. The original paper dealt with positions and momenta. In 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen published their thought experiment in a paper entitled "Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" At that time, Bohr, Heisenberg, and the proponents of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics were saying that quantum theory is a complete theory even though it doesn't provide any picture of the world separate from our observations of it. They're still saying it. The message that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen wanted to convey to their colleagues was that the quantum theory is not a complete theory because it does not describe certain important aspects of reality which are physically real, even if they are not observed. The message that their colleagues got, however, was quite different. The message that their colleagues got was that the particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment somehow are connected in a way that transcends our usual ideas about causality. For example, if the axis of the Stern-Gerlach device in our hypothetical experiment were changed to make the particles spin right or left instead of up or down, the experiment would look different. The particle shooting off to the right would have a spin right instead of a spin up. This means that the particle shooting off to the left would have a spin left instead of a spin down. Its spin is always equal and opposite to that of its twin. Now suppose that the axis of the Stern-Gerlach device is changed while the particles are in flight. Somehow, the particle traveling to the left knows that its twin to the right is spinning right instead of up, so it spins left instead of down. In other words, what we did to the right, changed the axis of the magnetic field, affected what happened to the left. This strange phenomenon is known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, or EPR, effect. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen's thought experiment is the Pandora's box of modern physics. It inadvertently illustrated an unexplainable connectedness between particles in two different places. The particle to the left seems to know instantaneously the spin status of the particle to the right. This connectedness allows an experimenter in one place, the right, to affect the state of a system in another place, to the left. It is rather discomforting, remarked Erwin Schrödinger in reference to this phenomenon, that the quantum theory should allow a system to be steered or piloted into one or the other type of state at the experimenter's mercy, in spite of his having no access to it. At once, physicists realized that this peculiar situation raises a critical question. How can two of anything communicate so quickly? According to the usual ideas in physics, information is carried from one place to another by a signal. Without a carrier, there is no communication. For example, the most common form of communication is talking. The information that we convey by talking is carried in a face-to-face conversation by sound waves. Sound waves only travel so fast, about 700 miles per hour. Therefore, how long it takes my information to get from me to you depends upon how far away from me you are. The fastest communication signal is an electromagnetic wave, like a light wave or a radio wave. These travel at approximately 186,000 miles per second. Almost all of physics rests upon the assumption that nothing in the universe can travel faster than the speed of light. The extraordinarily high velocity of light makes communication by light signal seem instantaneous. I seem to see you nod your head at the moment that you actually do it. Nonetheless, communication by light signal is not instantaneous. How long it takes my information to travel via light signal from me to you depends upon how far away from me you are. In most instances, the travel time required is so brief that it scarcely can be measured. It takes several seconds, however, for a radio signal to travel from the Earth to the Moon and back. Now, suppose that the two areas in our Stern-Gerlach experiment are very far apart. It will take a certain amount of time for a light signal to travel from the area to the right to the area to the left. If the area to the right and the area to the left are so far apart that there is insufficient time for a light signal to connect an event that happens to the right with an event that happens to the left, there is no way, according to the usual ideas in physics, that the event to the left can know about the event to the right. Physicists call this a space-like separation. One event is space-like separated from another event if there is insufficient time for a light signal to connect them. Communication between space-like separated events defies one of the most basic assumptions of physics. Yet this is exactly what the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment seems to illustrate. Even though they are space-like separated, the state of the particle shooting off to the left depends upon what the observer to the right decides to observe, or which way he orients his magnetic field. In other words, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect indicates that information can be communicated at superluminal, faster than light, speeds, contrary to the accepted ideas of physics. If the two particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment somehow are connected by a signal, that signal is traveling faster than the speed of light. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen may have created the first scientific example of a superluminal connection. Einstein himself denied this conclusion. It is not possible, he argued, that the setting we choose for a measuring device here can affect what happens somewhere else. In his autobiography, written 11 years after the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, he wrote, "On one supposition we should, in my opinion, absolutely hold fast. The real factual situation of the system S2, the particle to the left, is independent of what is done with the system S1, or the particle to the right, which is spatially separated from the former." This opinion is, in effect, the principle of local causes. The principle of local causes says that what happens in one area does not depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like separated area. The principle of local causes is common sense. The results of an experiment in a place distant and space-like separated from us should not depend on what we decide to do or not to do right here. Except for the mother who rose an alarm at the same instant that her daughter's distant automobile crashed into a tree, and similar cases, the macroscopic world appears to be made of local phenomena. Since phenomena are local in nature, argued Einstein, quantum theory has a serious flaw. According to quantum theory, changing the measuring device to the right changes the wave function which describes the particle to the left. But, according to Einstein, it cannot change the real factual situation of the system S2, which is independent of what is done with the system S1. Therefore, one and the same factual situation to the left has two wave functions, one for each position of the measuring device to the right. This is a flaw, since it is impossible that two different types of wave functions should be coordinated with the identical factual situation of S2. Here's another way of looking at the same situation. Since the real factual situation to the left is independent of what is done to the right, there must exist simultaneously to the left a definite spin up or down and a definite spin right or left to account for all the results that we can get by orienting the Stern-Gerlach device to the right, either vertically or horizontally. Quantum theory is not able to describe such a state to the left, and therefore it is an incomplete theory. However, Einstein closed his argument with an incredible aside. One can escape from this conclusion, that quantum theory is incomplete, only by either assuming that the measurement of S1 telepathically changes the real situation of S2, or by denying independent real situations as such to things which are spatially separated from each other. Both alternatives appear to me entirely unacceptable. Although these alternatives were unacceptable to Einstein, they are being considered by physicists today. Few physicists believe in telepathy, but some physicists do believe either that at a deep and fundamental level there is no such thing as independent real situations of things which have interacted in the past, but which are spatially separated from each other, or that changing the measuring device to the right does change the real factual situation to the left. This brings us to Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem is a mathematical proof. What it proves is that if the statistical predictions of quantum theory are correct, then some of our common sense ideas about the world are profoundly mistaken. Bell's theorem does not demonstrate clearly in what way our common sense ideas about the world are inadequate. There are several possibilities. Each possibility has champions among the small number of physicists who are familiar with Bell's theorem. No matter which of the implications of Bell's theorem we favor, however, Bell's theorem itself leads to the inescapable conclusion that if the statistical predictions of quantum theory are correct, then our common sense ideas about the world are profoundly deficient. This is quite a conclusion because the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics are always correct. Quantum mechanics is the theory. It has explained everything from subatomic particles to transistors to stellar energy. It never has failed. It has no competition. Quantum physicists realized in the 1920s that our common sense ideas were inadequate for describing subatomic phenomena. Bell's theorem shows that common sense ideas are inadequate even to describe macroscopic events, events of the everyday world. As Henry Stapp wrote, "The important thing about Bell's theorem is that it puts the dilemma posed by quantum phenomena clearly into the realm of macroscopic phenomena. It shows that our ordinary ideas about the world are somehow profoundly deficient even on the macroscopic level." Bell's theorem has been reformulated in several ways since Bell published the original version in 1964. No matter how it is formulated, it projects the irrational aspects of subatomic phenomena squarely into the macroscopic domain. It says that not only do events in the realm of the very small behave in ways which are utterly different from our common sense view of the world, but also that events in the world at large, the world of freeways and sports cars, behave in ways which are utterly different from our common sense view of them. This incredible statement cannot be dismissed as fantasy because it is based upon the awesome and proven accuracy of the quantum theory itself. Bell's theorem is based upon correlations between paired particles similar to the pair of hypothetical particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment. For example, imagine a gas that emits light when it is electrically excited. Think of a neon sign. The excited atoms in the gas emit photons in pairs. The photons in each pair fly off in opposite directions. Except for the difference in their direction of travel, the photons in each pair are identical twins. If one of them is polarized vertically, the other one also is polarized vertically. If one of the photons in the pair is polarized horizontally, the other photon is also polarized horizontally. No matter what the angle of polarization, both photons in every pair are polarized in the same plane. Therefore, if we know the state of polarization of one of the particles, we automatically know the state of polarization of the other particle. This situation is similar to the situation in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment, except that now we are discussing states of polarization instead of spin states. We can verify that both photons in each pair of photons are polarized in the same plane by actually sending them through polarizers. A light source in the center of our experiment emits a pair of photons. On each side of the light source, a polarizer is placed in the path of the emitted photon. Behind the polarizers are photomultiplier tubes which emit a click, or an inaudible electronic equivalent, whenever they detect a photon. Whenever the photomultiplier tube to the right of our light source emits a click, the photomultiplier tube to the left also emits a click. This is because both of the photons in each photon pair always are polarized in the same plane, and both of the polarizers in this arrangement are aligned in the same direction, in this case vertically. There is no theory involved here, just a matter of counting clicks. We know and can verify that when the polarizers both are aligned in the same direction, the photomultiplier tubes behind them will click an equal number of times. The clicks to the right are correlated with the clicks to the left. The correlation in this case is 1. Whenever one of the photomultiplier tubes clicks, the other photomultiplier tube always clicks as well. Now suppose that we orient one of the polarizers at 90 degrees to the other. This book is continued on cassette 8, side 1.